Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
I don't want to lose my place. My name is Arnold, and I'm an alcoholic.
How you doing?
I would be remiss if I didn't share something with you this evening. And it's about a dream. And the people in this room tonight are participating in the continuation of the journey and a personal dream of my friend Reggie A. You see, it was about 1999 in June that he and I were standing out along the Connecticut River in Moodus, Connecticut, at something called Soberfest, and he shared with me this dream of hosting a men's conference. And that night I stood in front of about, 800 people in a coat and tie at about 100 degree temperature and sweated off about 75 or 80 pounds and committed to him that if he ever had the opportunity to do it, I would be. Now, I get the opportunity, like many of you, to go to a lot of conventions and conferences. And if you've ever had the opportunity to host one of these, while it looks like the swan on the lake at the zoo, very, very serene and peaceful, and there's coffee and water and everything, underneath this stuff is a bevy of activity. People are just paddling their legs off. And before I say another word, I want you to salute Reggie and his crew of workers for hosting us this weekend. So thank you very much. My sobriety date, and if I get a little misty, it's because I've got a lot of things going on. And if I can hang around and be with you people until June 20th of this year, I will have been in your glorious fellowship 20 years. June 20, 1982 is my sobriety date. And as I say that to you, I also need to share with you that if I got halfway honest about it, I'd have to tell you that it wasn't my intention to get this sober. I didn't know where I was going to be on April the 5th of 2002 when I was brought back to Alcoholics Anonymous on June the 20th of 82. But I can tell you that if you had asked me that question that morning, I would have said, it's not going to be in Omaha, Nebraska, speaking to a crowd as lovely and as sober as yourselves. And the reason I say that is because I had been to Alcoholics Anonymous 5 years before, and it had not taken. And I didn't see any reason why it would take this time either. In 1977, at the age of 25 years old, I had managed to have a very, very steep career track as a banker in Baltimore, Maryland. And I had surrounded myself with enough trinkets that kept me from looking like the drunken bum that I was. And I'm talking about a mortgage and two cars and wife number one. And the reason I say that is because as we go along, you'll see that I have to talk about wives in rotation. But I need to share with you that in 1977, I came to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting with a buddy. And I came with a buddy, Michael D. I didn't come for myself. I came to shut Michael up. You see, for years at this bank where I work, and when I give this talk, I never say which bank I worked for in the Baltimore metropolitan region, but it was the only two national banks in the area, and I was with one of them. And the reason I don't say which one it is because You may move there someday. Or you may have stock in one of those places. And if I name it, you may run out tonight and try to get your money back, and we've left about four or five people in the room. Or somebody may do something worse and make a deposit. But I don't want to, either way, I don't want anything like that to happen. So I don't give the name. But only two, and I'll do one of them. Michael and I had come to the bank years at the same time, right after I left college, or he had left college, and we had become friends. And we drank together as bankers. We got promoted together. And what had happened was Michael's drinking had gotten him in trouble at work. And they asked me to take Michael to treatment. And if you can imagine when you were drinking when somebody asked you to do a favor for him, well, they asked me to do it for Michael at lunchtime. And I drank at lunchtime. So I took Michael to treatment, and I sort of like pushed him out of a moving car, you know. And when he came back, he was like any other newcomer you've ever seen in your home group. You know, when you're just getting sobriety and you're on fire. Well, that was Michael. And so every afternoon, he would stop by my office and say, Arnold, because he loved his friend. And he wanted to see his friend sober. And he would say, Arnold, I'm going to an AA meeting. Why don't you come and go with me? And I would say, Michael, I'm going to a meeting up at the Calvert House where we're going to do some drinking. Maybe you should come and go with me. You've been a little tight lately. And so just to shut him up, I went to my first AA meeting. Let me tell you what I encountered that day. First of all, let me paint the scene. We went to a church basement in downtown Baltimore, the old Cathedral Street meeting. And they had an aisle right down the center and chairs on both sides. And on one side of the room, people were sitting up, going up, sobered up. Mike sat with them. On the other side, however, people were drunked up, throwing up, cutting up, and I sat with my people. And I grabbed that loser's chair, you know, that one in the last row where you have 1 foot in the room and 1 foot out. And that's where I sat for an hour. And I was curious about the goings on because someone gave a lead and everybody passed it around. It was a discussion meeting. And I sensed that people were putting a high premium on not drinking. I got that much. And so after the meeting, I'm an inquisitive guy. I sort of went up to the front to ask some questions. And to this day, like in those days, I have a keen eye for talent. I can spot people that know stuff. And so I spotted this guy who I thought that might know stuff. And I said to him, and maybe you have made this statement. What is Alcoholics Anonymous? I said that. And he looked at me and he said, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't drink one day at a time. And I can't describe for you tonight the sadness that came over my face. But it wasn't a sadness as if you would just think about it. I took an inventory after he said that to me. And at 25, I had to go all the way back till I was like age 17 before I could come upon a day when I had not had a drink. And if that was the requirement, I knew I couldn't be a member. He saw that, and he said, whoa, wait a minute, said, Arnold. He said, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't drink even if our butts fall off. I heard that too. Took an inventory, and I'm a pretty sensitive guy. I can feel mine loosening up. I'm not going to wait till it falls. I'm going to go ahead and drink. And then he further confused me that afternoon when he said that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we believe in easy does it. I heard that. And I matched that up with my experience. This afternoon, you heard Dave share about his family background. And that's basically where the story starts for all of us in the family. And I'm going to do a little bit of that right now. And I'm doing that only because to tell you why, when he said, easy does it, I come from a background of people where everybody went to work every day and worked 1, 2, 3 jobs. I know easy don't get nothing. You have to work for what you get in this life. So, with that information, no wonder I didn't stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I bounced in and out for the next 5 years. Because that afternoon I realized that in Alcoholics Anonymous, people will tell you that lie if you let them. It's not really a lie. It's a lie if you want to do nothing about your drinking. The lie is, Arnold, it's going to be all right. For guys like me that don't want to quit drinking, it ain't going to be all right. But it's nice to hear when you're getting them hugs from them women, you know, and they might slide you a fiver or something, you know what I'm saying, when you ain't. But it ain't. That's a lie. And so, in the next 5 years, when I went to work and heard Arnold seek help or seek employment elsewhere, I came back to Ed, because y'all would say, it's going to be all right. When eventually that first wife said, Arnold, I'm pretty sick of mowing our lawn on Saturday because you're too drunk to do it. Get out of here. Get out. I came back to A because y'all said it was going to be all right. It ain't going to be all right. Arnold Ross's story begins in 1944, right around June. What happened in June of 44? Alcoholics Anonymous. Anybody know? No. I got a grapevine chair in this room. You! Grapevine was published June 1944. Bill, put the first one out. In June 1944, in Durham, North Carolina, Flash, my father is on the stage at Hillside High School getting his diploma and looks out in the audience and sees Carrie Wooten, my mom, and he liked it. November of 1950, as Dr. Bob is leaving us, I am conceived. 1951, as Bill Wilson is having the first General Service Conference trial, March, I am born that year. And let me tell you what happened. In 1951, when my mother gave birth to Arnold, 10.5-pound baby boys was not the norm. This woman almost gave her life that I could have mine. And as a result of that activity, there were to be no other children to the union of Lloyd and Carrie Ross. I'm it. And these people spent countless days and hours in Durham, North Carolina, as their only son grew up, saying these words, "We want you to grow up and be somebody." Well, let me tell you, you hear that about 4 or 5 years, you come to understand that maybe you will be somebody later on, that you might not be anybody right at that moment. You laugh, but that's a weird feeling. It gives you that feeling of difference, that feeling that you don't fit any place, that feeling that when you out back as a little kid, playing in the rocks, and you turn over one and see those white worms, and you go, yup, that's how that feels, only it's all the time. And that feeling was born out one day when I was in the third grade. You see, Reggie tells you this, usually when I say my name is Arnold, I'm an alcoholic, somebody says, Arnold, stand up. They think that's real funny that I'm taller than everybody else. And it really is. But this particular day, I was third or fourth grade, and Ms. Saunders was out in the playground, and this had never happened before. She said, kids, we're going back inside, line up according to height. And every kid on that playground found me in the line form from where I stood forward. Now, let me tell you what I did that day. It's real crystal clear. And it's crystal because you people have given me the opportunity to do inventory and write about it and go and visit this stuff. It's a similar feeling to what Bill Wilson describes in the Pass It On, where he talks about being a number one guy at all costs, throwing that boomerang at. I decided that day I may have to be in the back of the line because of my height, but I'm going to do everything I possibly can, no matter what, to demonstrate to people that I'm number one. I'm going to be the best athlete and the best student anybody has ever seen. And you can do that for a while. And when you're not successful, you begin to make concessions. That's what happened to me. 1966, thereabouts, my father moved our family to Baltimore. And I'll never forget this, coming to Baltimore at 16 years of age, having left the place where, in Durham, where I had a lot of friends, and being cast into an environment where I didn't know anybody, and having to start that over. I'll never forget being in high school and everybody sitting every other chair with nobody around me. I'll never forget that. I hope I never do. I hope I never forget those feelings of loneliness and fear and being out of place. And the reason I don't want to forget that is because I can go visit that place because I'm around people like you all the time. You see, I like myself best when I'm with you guys today. But I'll never forget the fact that in those days, in order to get by and being 6'4", 100 pounds, we had names for people. See, kids are cruel. We tease. After the night, if you see me out in the hall this weekend, Arnold's fine. You don't have to call me Slim or Treetop or none of those. You see, I've got some that Reggie can't take. I won't even bore you with those. See, honestly, in the day that cursing is not a sign of spiritual growth. I won't do that to you. But I can remember like it was yesterday gravitating toward this crowd of older guys. And let me tell you, if you ever been to Baltimore, Maryland, I grew up running up and down Cold Spring Lane with some guys that were 18, 19, and a 1964 Dodge Dart red with a push-button dash. You're dating yourself. Looking for girls. That's what we did. And one Friday night we found some. Didn't know what to do with them, but we had it. And we asked them what they were doing. They said they were going to a CYO dance. I had never been to a CYO dance. You see, I have another disease outside of alcoholism. It's called Southern Baptism. It's fatal and progressive, too. You never get over it. I was raised in the Mount Gilead Baptist Church being drug around with my grandmother, and she went every time the door was open. We passed there one Wednesday. The door was open. They were putting down carpet. We went in because they were open. It was her way. But we went to the CYO dance, and I felt out of place. There was a woman. She was old. I'm 16. She had to be all 24, 25. Came up to us, had on a costume. You know, nuns wore those. I didn't know it was a habit. I thought it was a costume. And she said, go down there and dance with those girls and do it right now. I did something that night that was to be the way I handled any pressure from that time forward. And that is run. And I went to the men's room, and there was some guys standing in a circle, and there was an interesting ritual. I had never seen it. They were passing around a flask, and I stepped into the circle, and I was watching very carefully, and everybody's taking one and sending it to the next guy. And so when it got right here, I took that baby and hit it and sent it to the next guy. And let me tell you, if I think real hard tonight, I can still feel that warm, burning sensation that traveled down through my face and down my chest cavity and into my stomach and down one leg and back up and then down the other. And the change began to happen. Something happened that night that I didn't know wasn't happening to everybody in that circle. So it came around again, and I took mine and sent it to the next guy. And 2 inches behind my belly button, there is this magical lava filling in all those holes and cracks that I have experienced for years. I thought everybody in that circle was feeling the same thing. But they weren't. After the second time around, I reached across and grabbed it out of the guy's hand. I have often thought to myself, what would have happened to people like us if that change hadn't taken place that night? People like us who desperately needed to be changed. What would have happened if nothing would have happened? You can see other people don't have to get changed like us. I need to be changed. And so I came out of that men's room, as my daughter would say, ready for the world. Newfound social skills. Danced. I was all over the place that night with all the girls for about 45 minutes. And then they were out back dragging me around and scuffing up my shoes. Took me back down to the white coffee pot and poured coffee, and I poured it right back out on the ground. And when they got tired, they took me over to my parents' and rang the bell and left me there. And I told my first lie about drinking that night to my mom. She opened the door and she said, "Where have you been?" Because there wasn't any drinking in our household. None. I said, "Mama, I went to a party, had some bad tuna fish. I got to go upstairs." And I went upstairs and she bought it. I went upstairs and I laid on the bed and the bed spun around. You know, when I put my foot out to break it. You know, that rookie stuff we do. And couldn't wait to do it again. Okay? Let's talk history. April 4, 1968. What happened? Dr. King was killed. That's right. Dr. King was killed. My dad came home from work and said, "You know, Cara, we're going to that funeral." And we drove all night to Atlanta. And if you ever see that picture, that Sea of Humanity coming across Spring Street, I'm one of them folks. And it changed my life. Up until that point, that guy who wanted to be number one in everything, both athletics and in academia, had moved to a place where it was okay to be number two, three, four, and occasionally not even show up. So when we got up on Morehouse's campus, I saw that and I thought, I might be able to do this college thing. And so I came from Baltimore down to Morehouse in pre-med. Before you get any noble notions about my becoming a doctor or trying to solve diseases or developing anything like that, let me beg you not to. You see, I remember being a little kid in Durham, North Carolina, and the guy in town who had the most money was the undertaker. See, I was trying to get into mortuary science school, and the way to get there is through pre-med. You see, I'm the kind of guy who wants to make a lot of money and not talk to anybody, and you can do that in the funeral business. And that speaks volumes about my personality. That's all I need to say. Reggie, you can wrap it up now. We can go home. Page 62, selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of any rate. And that was me. And I was in college during that period, man, in late 60s, early 70s, where in life I just bounced. If it came along, I just bounced. I mean, I didn't have any direction, but I was there. And in those days, my drinking got me to a place. Remember those days when your drinking got you promoted upwards? You were just in the right spot. And I managed to get a job working for a bank as a senior in college. And there were 49 of us working there doing these things. At the end of the year, 48 people were offered jobs. And when I went down to find out why I didn't get an offer, I sat in front of a woman who looked kind of like Aunt B, bun in the back of her head, kind of portly woman. And she was my first 12-step call. Now, everybody in this room has been on 12-step calls. Let me tell you how she started hers. Mr. Ross, do you ever take showers? Well, what she was trying to share with me that day was that the vodka I drank before coming to work was coming out of my pores, and they could smell it. But in 1973, they didn't have any EAP programs. So that's how she started off. And let me tell you what I did. I did my best Stokely Carmichael A-Trap Brown stuff to her. Now, I've since had to go back and find that woman and get that straight. Don't get me wrong. But, I mean, I just did that tangent thing. It was as if, I don't know about you, but in those days, my drinking was as if I started off toward over there where this guy's getting water, I ended up over here getting coffee with me trying to convince you that's what I had in mind all along. That was my intention. And so I came back to Baltimore and got a job at that depository I was telling you about and ended up in a program being orientated. Sitting next to my boy, Michael. And Michael and I heard the same thing that morning. Fellas, there's a cafeteria at the end of the hall. That's where we have lunch. And at lunchtime, we started down there, and a guy grabbed us and said, nobody eats down there. We eat at the Calvert House. And Michael and I, as young bankers, started going to the Calvert House. And we started off getting a burger and a beer. The next day it was kill that burger, give us two beers. And in 1977, taking him to treatment. Well, let me finish this up so we can go on and do what we're going to do tonight. Ice cream, right? Tonight you heard somebody read, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. One thought. Dash. That our lives became unmanageable. From 1977 to 1982, I lived in that dash. I knew very early that I was powerless over alcohol. I just could not attach that to an unmanageable life. No big deal. Those things happen. And through a series of events, which I'm going to describe to you, they got linked up. I eventually got asked, you know, in the banking business, nobody ever gets fired. People get different jobs. I began to get jobs that required a lot of talent but no presence since I couldn't seem to get there every day. And that meant I would be outside. They gave me work outside, calling on people. And I remember during this period of time in the late 80s, late 81 thereabouts, I went into my daytime drinking phase. Daytime drinking, gentlemen, is different from nighttime drinking. Nighttime drinking is described on the pages of this book in A Vision for You. I think they use the word convivial. Daytime drinking is every three stools. Nobody talks to anybody. Everybody has a 1,000-yard stare. Everybody has a big deal that's going to pop next week and make $1 million. But at any rate, I was sitting there one afternoon doing some daytime. Daytime drinking is when you come in and there's this bar person who is about a 3 or 4, and when you finish your daytime drinking, you want to marry her and take her home. Okay. I was doing some of that late 81, and I had a thought bubble, kind of like Andy Kapp. And the thought was this. It was a sentence, because in those days they didn't last paragraphs. The thought was clear that for 16 years of my life, Lloyd and Carrie Ross had taken care of me, and handed me to a basketball coach in college who took care of me, who had given me to a first wife who had taken care of me, and then I had been by myself for about 4 or 5 years, living life as a miserable failure. And that's where the thought stopped. I connected the thought with, I better find somebody to take care of me. And shortly thereafter, I did. I ran into this woman who was drinking in a place in downtown Baltimore, and I sent her over a drink and told the waitress till I'd be over to propose in a second. And she brought the drink back and threw it in my face. I knew I was in love. I began to propose to her every time I saw her, and what she said to me was, Arnold, I just finished a marriage of 8 years to a drunk. I don't know a drunk in my life. And I watched something kind of like what Dave described, you know, this afternoon in his talk was something I really wanted to make me whole about to disappear. And what I did was I said I quit drinking. And she said, that's pretty good. But why don't you try that for about 6 months and we'll chat. So I left the gate January of 1982 with black knuckle sobriety. I didn't try to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew it was here. I just gritted my teeth and stayed sober. And every time I saw this woman, I tried to propose, and she said, keep it up. And right around March, as it says in our big book, without enlarging my spiritual life, I entered the surrender place to come to you. I didn't even know why I entered it. I started to drink one day and stayed drunk for days and days and days. I began to view a good day and a bad day in a very, very strange way. The strange way was that if I had money in my pocket to go out and drink, that was a good day. A bad day, if I had to go out and try to get some money out of Earl so he would buy me a drink, I listened to his nonsense. That was a bad day. And I woke up on June the 19th of 1982, and it was a good day. I had money in my pockets, and I was going to do some drinking. It was a Saturday night. And I'm a big-time jazz fan. Reggie knows it. And I'm straight ahead. I'm Miles, Bird, Coltrane. Don't give me none of this, Grover. I mean, I'm straight ahead. And so I went down to this spot, and they were da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, doing that thing. And I'm in there, and I'm with it. And my shades went down. And again, I had black ops when it first came out. And so my shades went down, and when they came back up, I was at a club, and they were doing country western, and I was in mid-sentence. And you don't let on that you don't know. You go with the bit. You stay with it. And I stayed with it, and I did a couple of U-alls, and shades went down and came back up again, and I was at a place where they were clogging on stage, you know, river dance kind of stuff. And when they went back down and came back up again, I came to the next morning, and I came to the serenade of Arnold Ross, You May Bail. And when I gathered myself, I realized I was lying on the concrete floor of the Baltimore City Jail. If you know anything about the disease that I have, you know it's very, very nasty. And I'm only going to make one reference to it. I was lying in some pools of liquid, and they may have been my own. I was in a drunk tank, and he throws in there in the pile. Enough said. You ain't been there. You ain't never been. You ain't got to go. I did that. And on June 20th, about 11 o'clock, I walked out of that jail cell. It was Father's Day. It was my father's birthday. And my gift to my father that year was to come and get his son out of jail. And he did. Let me tell you why he did. Remember my buddy Michael D. that tried to get me sober in 1977? Michael D. knew the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in this book it says that occasionally you work with families and you may have to leave this bum alone because he's not ready. Well, he worked with my parents so that just in case I might be ready, they know what to do. And they bailed me out. It's about 10 of 11 on that Sunday morning. And by this time in my drinking, my alarm clock goes off for one about 6. You ever experienced that?
You don't need an alarm clock. 6 o'clock comes, you got to get a hit. You go get it. It's about 10 minutes to 11, and I'm needing it. Things are not going well. And it's the scene like Branded. Chuck Connors being put out of the fort, where we're walking and ain't nobody talking. And I know we get in that car, it's going to be some strong talking to. And it's a similar case to what Bill describes when he drags that mattress down 3 flights where his mind is racing uncontrollably. My mind is racing uncontrollably. What am I going to tell you? My mother and father? Well, we got in the car, man, we drove up Gay Street, and my father pulled into a gravel parking lot. He said, "Get out of the car, boy." And I thought, damn, he wants to fight. which is okay. Now, don't get me wrong. I like that kind of activity. You know, that's exercise, you know. But not when you need one, you know. Because, see, I'm the kind of guy that drank for effect. I don't know about him. If you told me we were going to meet some girls one night, I'd drink rum. Because rum makes me a lover. And if we're going to fight, I'm going to be drinking some gin or vodka, because you got to get mean if you're going to be in the fight, and it makes me mean. And so, but nevertheless, my dad asked me to follow him across this gravel parking lot toward a building with the sun shining on it that was purple, and that's not the color if you got a bad head. But at any rate, we got to this door, and the door opened up, and I participated that morning in my first spiritual experience. Maybe you've had this one. It's the one where they talk about what to do with you. You can't participate. It's like an out-of-body thing. You're standing there watching this, but you can't share. And they're talking. And I remember my father saying to Dave McQuaig. Dave's about as tall as this lectern. And my father said to Dave, you know, maybe you people. That's what he called it. You people. Maybe you people can help my son because I'm out of answers. And with that, he pushed me across the door sill onto Dave. Dave caught me. I would have fallen down. And my life hasn't been the same since. You see, in that alcove that morning was Dave McQuaig, God rest his soul, Arthur English, God rest his soul, Charlie M., who's Agnes. And these people didn't talk about stuff that they had heard in sharing meetings. Like, we don't drink one day at a time. They knew this book, and they were prepared to do what it says in that book. See, in this book, it says, when you're working with newcomers, that we should stress the fatal feature freely. And what I was told that Sunday morning is, Arnold, if you continue to drink the way you've been drinking, the good news is you will die. I'm 30 years old. Have matriculated from 2 different universities. That don't sound like good news to me. I know good news when I hear it. That ain't it. And then they said, and the bad news is, you might go insane first and be a burden to somebody, but you'll die nevertheless. And me in my sick arrogance said in retort, what's my third choice? There ain't no third choices. These people have seen me bouncing in and out of here for 5 years. They knew the book. I asked the question, you know me and questions. I said, well, listen. After they had told me their stories, all 4 of them, I said, let me ask this question. You people seem to be much older than me. If I have the same disease that you people have, and I'm going to die, how come you people aren't already dead? Y'all much older. And they said, well, smarty, we have 12 suggested principles that taken, and we put numbers on them for smart guys like you. Know the order. That's just why we're not dead. And they invited me to go upstairs in this place and do what we've all done, and that's get on our knees and say, God help me, I'm a drunk. I was so sick and confused and arrogant, I went upstairs and leaned over the bed and said, to whom it may concern, God help me. I wasn't sure nobody was listening, man. You know, I need help. I need help bad. going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in this place, and I'm pulled into a coffee pot about 3 or 4 days later, and I'm getting a cup of coffee, and a guy standing there, and he says, my name is Wayne, and I'm going to be your sponsor because you're too stupid to get one. I heard that, and didn't know what it meant, but Wayne came with the notion, my first experience of personal sponsorship, and personal sponsorship meant that he allowed me to be so close to him that I could witness where he put his feet. Once he moved them, I could put mine there, as it pertained to the business of living. I spent 28 days in this place and doing all those things, that spin dry stuff that we do. And I managed to convince this woman that I had been chasing that I was going to be okay. And we eventually got married. And this marriage came with an 11-year-old daughter who was a bundle of love. And while I just told you about how I got sober, that did nothing for my recovery. That woman who I married wife number two, jump-started my recovery at about 9 months in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, at a 9-month mark in AA, I was at a place whereby is that I was ready to get back to the captaincy of the Rosa Rosa ship. And that meant dictating things at the house. And you see, I would ask for a steak and some French cut string beans and maybe some baked potato, and I would come home and get beans. And I would forgive her discretion. But when you're in early recovery, forgiveness sounds like this. You know you screwed up, but I overlook it. And we had a chat one evening, and Terry said to me, that if I thought people were going to bow down and bathe me in swaddling clothes for getting sober, that I should go get drunk. And since I wasn't back to work just yet, here was a fiver to get me started. And I went to the phone and called my sponsor about that. And I told him that story. He said, Arnold, what step are you working? I said, Wayne, never mind that step. I got an uneven playing field here. Can you tell me what to say? And he said, what step are you working? And finally, just to shut him up, I said, Wayne, I'm doing the 1, 2, 3 waltz. I'm stuck on 3. And he said, get unstuck and come over here. Well, let me tell you, you go to your sponsor's house and he's sitting on the sofa by himself grinning. That's pretty intimidating. If you get over there and his sponsor sitting there beside him grinning too, that's downright frightening. And that's what happened to me. But they took the opportunity that night to put me through an exercise about the God of my understanding. And they talked about Alcoholics Anonymous. They talked about God and making a decision. And they talked about the Ross plan. And we came to the idea that the Ross plan sucked. We may have to deal with God's plan and AA. And they had examples of all these things. And so I was honored. We got on our knees and we held hands. And Richard started to say, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me. And then he stood up and said, no, Arnold, all your life, people have done stuff for you. You're gonna take this book, go home, learn that prayer, come back here, grab our hands, and say it for yourself. And if you can't do it, that's fine. He said, but you understand something? Wayne and I have to be about working with folks that want to be sober. You can still come around. Don't look for any assistance from us. We want to stay sober too and find some guys that want. And I am so grateful that I found the willingness to be able to come over there, grab their hands, kneel down, say the prayer. I got to tell you something. You need to be very careful when you say that prayer. Because there's a catchphrase. As thou wilt. Phew. That means you don't get a chance to do nothing. God's going to do it. And I thought I'd done a whole lot at that point, and they said I hadn't. They said I needed that. They said that would wear off. In the book it says, Father, that's a very vital stuff that'll wear off. And so they gave me a pad and a pencil, and we did some inventory, and it was pretty hard. And we did it only in resentments, and we did it on our fears, and I was afraid of everything. I didn't like nothing. And I related to people very, very poorly, so it took a while. And we went through the exercise of having to admit these things to all three. And I don't know about anybody in this room, but that was the first time I can remember in my life where I had the same story for everybody all the time. If you were to catch me, man, I had a story for Reggie. I had a story for Earl, one for Kurt, one for Dave. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to say the same thing to three different entities the same way. And got the benefit of those promises that are on page 75. I didn't have to wait till way back in the 80s. There's someone 75 you can grab. Like looking people in the eye and being delighted. Things like that this guy had never fathomed. Got a home group, had it for a long time. It was the welcome group in those days. I'm a member of the Minnesota group today, but in those days, the welcome group had monthly business meetings. And I went to the bathroom and came back GSR, which is pretty normal. Woo! And got bit by the bug of service. Didn't know it, but that's how everybody does it. And spent time being a GSR. It was a wonderful time. 1982, 83, 84, we published some dynamite books, Pass It On. We did The Language of the Heart, Grapevine book. I mean, it was a marvelous time for Alcoholics Anonymous in the publishing thing. I got the opportunity to hear about these products and come back and share them with my home group members. And be a DCM and have the notion of working with 8 or 9, 10, 12 GSRs. Eventually being secretary and chair and delegate for Area 29 for Panel 46. And Dave mentioned something this afternoon about being the only black delegate in Delaware. We got more than that in this room, David. I'm going to stop right now and tell you that Kurt M's the first black delegate for Nebraska. That ain't no big deal. There are other delegates in this room. Y'all delegates, stand up. Where y'all at? I know y'all in here. Other past delegates. Stand up. No, there you are. Get up here, Kurt. Delegates. You got delegates all over. Servants. And Alcoholics Anonymous. And they started to serve because of things like this. Wanting to better their sobriety. Well, service jobs come and go. 2 years here, once you learn it, time to rotate. Rotation's a spiritual thing. I've experienced it. I get the opportunity now to serve you as a director on your Grapevine magazine. It's a 4-year commitment. I get a chance to come around and visit. We were in Chicago a couple of weeks back. We're here. We'll be at the conference with Kirk. It's the New York trip all the time. But it's because of people like you that I get a chance to go and participate in things like this. We had the opportunity to look at our family over the years as a group. Our family was similar to the one that Dave described earlier this afternoon. It was dysfunctional. We had an incident today with BG&E. And because of being an Alcoholics Anonymous, the incident got solved. Our group decided to have group conscience meetings. And we started them early. The first group conscience meeting we ever had as a family was to frame in a family budget. Worst one we ever had. Because you see, everybody has a different agenda. We came to this group conscious meeting thinking that we were framing a family budget. What we framed in was our family values. You see, the question becomes, what's our most important, or what's our primary purpose? And that is to be a family, and our primary bill is what? Dale says, JCPenney's, I buy my CDs there. That's good. My wife thought it was the phone bill. She was on it a lot. And I know it's not worth a tinker's damn without a mortgage payment. Now, how do you get a group conscience out of that? Unless a loving God shows up and demonstrates him or herself in the midst of us. And that happened. We saw that work. We saw it work, for about 18 years. And then one of the members in our group decided they didn't want to be a member anymore. And that happened. That's why we have a third tradition. It said that you're a member when you say you are. And when you want to exercise your autonomy in tradition four, we have to allow that to happen. Because even though members lead the group, you're still a family. You still have a primary purpose. You still have to trudge the road. You still have to walk with dignity and purpose. You still have to work with new things. You see, what has happened to me over the years is something that I said earlier. It's why I like myself best when I'm with you people. And I didn't come upon that all by myself. I heard that because I was with you. You see, I like myself best when I'm with y'all because you people tell me straight. If I'm off the beam, you tell me. If I'm on the beam, you say that. If I'm not around, you call. When I'm around, you feed me. How could I ever lose by not being here? By being here? I can't. Well, it's been a little while now. Haven't had to take a drink. People have come into the life and left. Experienced relatives die and be born. And been about the business of living as any other AA member has. While Lloyd and Carrie Ross were only able to have one son, and I never got the opportunity to experience brothers and sisters, I look around this room tonight and I feel good to know that I at least have this many brothers. And wherever I go in the world, with 25 cents, a phone call, and a directory, I can be home. And I can be home there because you people have allowed me to be home here. And for that, I'll be eternally grateful. Thank you for your lives.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.